From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the July 2017 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, PQ17, Disaster in the Arctic. This month we'll look into what happened when the Admiralty didn't believe the intelligence coming from Bletchley Park. The Tirpitz was a much feared German battleship. It was the biggest they'd ever built. Intelligence that it hadn't set sail yet came from Bletchley Park, but wasn't believed. So convoy PQ-17 was scattered, resulting in huge losses. In the summer of 1942, Bletchley Park was reading the German Navy's messages, but the wrong decision was still taken by the Admiralty. How did it go so wrong? Let's find out more from Bletchley Park's research historian, Dr. David Kenyon.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
I would say let's start at the beginning, but I want to start before the beginning. So I want to go back further than when PQ-17 happened and there were those terrible losses. I want to look at, firstly, how intelligence that was coming out of Bletchley Park was being perceived, perhaps in the period leading up to the summer of 1942.
Well, the relationship between the Admiralty and Bletchley Park developed much more slowly than it did perhaps with other departments, because it took Bletchley longer to read naval traffic in any significant quantity because it was much more complex. So it wasn't until late 1940 that they were making significant progress with decrypting Enigma. But Bletchley all the way along was collecting German messages, even though they couldn't read them, and doing a lot of traffic analysis and producing a lot of useful intelligence from just who was communicating with who and timings and things like that. And one of the real experts at this was Harry Hinsley, who famous Bletchley Park character latterly. But at this point, he was still a very young man. He was recruited from Cambridge before he'd finished his degree and put on to analysing German naval traffic and came up with some very impressive results. But the problem was he was a civilian. He was at Bletchley Park. He wasn't part of the Royal Navy and all their sort of traditions and establishment that they have. So when he started making suggestions to the Admiralty's Operational Intelligence Centre in London, he wasn't necessarily given the full hearing that he might have deserved.
And you can imagine them thinking of him as some boffin, some upstart that perhaps, you know, oh, they think they know everything. And his youth won't have helped that perception, will it?
Absolutely not, no.
Would they have been aware of him as an individual?
Not necessarily him as an individual, but they were aware of Bletchley Park as a source of intelligence information. The problem was that when Bletchley were producing intelligence that wasn't absolutely concrete, they didn't have a message saying a certain ship has sailed at a certain time, but they were producing intelligence that was based much more on inference. The Navy was less receptive to that. The classic case is the sinking of the aircraft carrier Glorious in 1940 during the Norway campaign. Glorious had made several journeys back and forth from the UK to Norway to deliver aircraft that were flown off the ship and landed in airfields in Norway to support the rather unsuccessful land campaign that was going on in Norway at the time. And Bletchley Park and Harry Hinsley in particular had noticed that there were messages that implied that German ships were sailing from the Baltic to the North Sea and that a threat was developing. But he couldn't say which ships specifically. He couldn't necessarily indicate the precise nature of the threat. As it turned out, it was the battlecruisers Scharnhorst and Gneisenau, which became more famous later on, that made it into the North Sea and were prowling around looking for Royal Navy ships. But the Royal Navy hadn't really taken on board any of this intelligence. And Glorious, having sailed over to Norway, was returning again to the UK. Lovely sunny day, calm ocean. They didn't have any of their own aircraft in the air. A carrier would normally have this thing called a combat air patrol, where you have aircraft flying, basically circling above the carrier to make sure that nothing's going to attack it. All their aircraft were on the deck, and they weren't really worrying about anything. They were just sailing along back to the UK. Next thing that happened, Scharnhorst and Gneisenauer appear over the horizon, and they sank both Glorious and two of her escorting destroyers with a loss of over 1,500 sailors.
Das Oberkommando der Wehrmacht gab am 9. Juni bekannt. Deutsche Seestreitkräfte, darunter die beiden Schlachtschiffe Gneisenau und Scharnhorst, operierten unter Führung des Admirals Marschall im Nordmeer. Inzwischen ist der englische Flugzeugträger Glorious gemeldet. Der 22.500 Tonnen große Koloss hat 48 Bombenflugzeuge an Bord. Die feindlichen Granaten liegen viel zu kurz. Breitseite auf Breitseite jagt aus den Rohren. Die Glorious ist bereits schwer getroffen. Die englischen Zerstörer versuchen den Flugzeugträger einzunebeln und damit der Sicht zu entziehen. Vergebens. Der Feind wird nicht mehr losgelassen. Immer wieder überschüttet Schnellfeuer schwersten Kalibers den Gegner. Die Glorious steht in Flammen. Die begleitenden Zerstörer sind schwer beschädigt und sinken im weiteren Verlauf des Gefechtes.
It was a rude shock to the Navy at that point. It was a real disaster. And one could argue that up to that point, the Royal Navy had lost two major ships up to that point. Royal Oak had been sunk by a German submarine within Scapa Flow, within the anchorage, and a previous aircraft carrier had been lost to a U-boat, but they weren't used to being attacked on the open sea like that. They were at war, but I don't think their frame of mind had really fully engaged with the fact that they were involved in a war. And I think the sinking of the Glorious was a big wake-up call to the Admiralty, and they did, after that, start taking Bletchley Park's output much, much more seriously.
Hinsley was one of the very few people, though. Have you met him?
I haven't spoken to him yet.
You can just see him, his head on one side there.
Oh, yes.
In this direction, right over to one side. That's Harry Hinsley, who wrote the official history. But he was extraordinary because he came here as a third-year undergraduate, about 1939 or 40. So he was dealing with the product of naval enigma. And he kept on saying, reporting to the Admiralty, look, there are indications, the messages are corrupt, but there are just enough signals, even the existence of signals on links that weren't used yesterday, etc., to suggest that the Germans are moving quite a lot of heavy naval units up the Norwegian coast. And the Admiralty said, right, oh, yes, how interesting. And they didn't do anything about it at all, because they thought, this is a, you know, third-year undergraduate, what does he know? He's only just started even break codes. Then suddenly, of course, the Germans invaded Norway, and they sank the aircraft carrier Glorious. And all of this was the sort of thing that Hinsley had been warning about. Yeah. And so after that, they started taking more notice. Yeah. And then he fed them all sorts of time. And he suggested twice capturing their weather ships up in the sort of Arctic waters, because they would have the latest in Enigma keys, which is what we needed. It wasn't the machines we needed, the keys, and so on. And goodness, he was a bright third-year student.
You look at that compared to the operation to find and sink the Bismarck a year later in 1941, it's clear that the relationship has developed substantially by then, and the Operation Intelligence Centre and the Admiralty are almost hanging on Bletchley's every word. They're looking at whatever messages are coming in. Again, you still have a problem that there's a time delay between when messages are intercepted and when the content is typically deciphered. So the hunt for the Bismarck is based not on the content of messages, which couldn't be read in near enough time, but on, again, on traffic analysis and on direction finding and other wireless intelligence techniques other than the pure code breaking. But it's more or less completely successful. It is a success. They sink the Bismarck.
Members of ENSA, they have entertained in the last few months officers and gallant men on the hood. You will feel as I feel about their last great gallant sacrifice. But the British Navy has, in all its decades of history, taken good care to avenge things of that kind. And that is why this morning at 11 o'clock the Bismarck was sunk.
Just remind us of how that happened, for those who don't know that story.
Again, the problem was that Bismarck had sailed into the Atlantic between Iceland and Greenland from the North Sea into the Atlantic. And German intention was to attack convoys out on the mid-Atlantic, which would have been disastrous. I mean, a convoy escorts would have been able to do nothing against a battleship like that, and it could have sunk a whole convoy at its leisure. So it was absolutely vital to sink the ship. Fortunately, the Royal Navy was lucky on a number of occasions. I mean, they had very bad luck at the beginning that the Bismarck encountered Hood and Prince of Wales, and Hood blew up and sank very shortly after the start of the battle, again with great loss of life. But enough damage was done to Bismarck that the Germans decided to sort of scrub the operation, and Bismarck was returning to port. But the question for the Allies, and the decision the Germans had to take, was whether to send it back round the north of Scotland to Norway or go south through the Bay of Biscay to France. And the Admiralty had to decide which way Bismarck was going to run. And they were lucky with signals intelligence of various kinds, messages from Bismarck herself, but also actually Luftwaffe messages sent from Greece, of all places, that gave clues to where she was going. And as a result of that, Bismarck was found and sunk successfully.
It's always a real jigsaw, isn't it, of putting together different bits of information from different sources and different ways and reasons people are talking about a specific thing to build a picture. And it's kind of the very definition of traffic analysis.
It's never as simple as getting one message that tells you everything you need to know. It's always much more about balancing snippets from one place and snippets from another place and coming up with a balance of probabilities. And that's really the crux of what went wrong with PQ-17.
At 4 o'clock this morning, Hitler attacked and invaded Russia. This was no surprise to me. In fact, I gave clear and precise warnings to Stalin of what was coming. I gave him warnings, as I have given warnings to others before. Hitler is a monster of wickedness, insatiable in his lust for blood and plunder. So now this bloodthirsty gutter snipe must launch his mechanized armies upon new fields of slaughter, pillage and devastation.
By the spring of 1941, most of the continent of Europe lay crushed and ruined in the wake of the war machine of Nazi Germany. Its many hungry peoples, prisoners or slaves. Its cities in ruins. And suddenly, turning without warning on his former ally, Hitler flung his armies against Soviet Russia in the most gigantic offensive in all history. On the 22nd of June 1941, with 4 million men massed along the 2,000-mile Russian border, Germany attacked. 175 divisions of young German soldiers poured into Russia, driving toward Moscow, Leningrad, and the destruction of the last threat to the German dominance of the continent of Europe. For weeks, gathered secretly along the border, thousands of German aircraft had been made ready for the destructive preliminary blow against the enemy concentration. Employing the strategy used so effectively against Poland and the Low Countries, the mission of the opening attack was to discover and destroy the enemy's principal command positions, supply lines, and communications.
So that was in 1941. Let's go ahead a year into the Arctic Ocean in 1942. What's happening? What's on the horizon?
In summer of 1941, the Germans attacked Soviet Russia. And more or less straight away, Stalin was very keen that the Allies should help him in some way. His big thing that he wanted was an invasion of Europe from the other end, from the West, a second front. And in the event, he was going to have to wait 3 years for that, because D-Day doesn't happen until 1944. But in the meanwhile, the Soviets were very much in need of support in terms of material, munitions, tanks, food, all sorts. So pretty much straight away after the Germans' attack, the British set up convoys to supply the Russians with war material of all kinds. And the first convoys sail in August 1941. And actually, for the first 6 months or so, the convoys pass more or less undisturbed. I mean, by the spring of 1942, only one merchant ship has been sunk out of a dozen convoys or more. So it's been a fairly successful operation from the point of view of the amount of material it's getting to Russia. The problem is you have two times of year. You have the winter when it's dark all the time in the Arctic, so convoys are harder for the Germans to find. Their air reconnaissance can't see them. But because so much of the ocean is iced up, the ice cap travels south in the winter, and so the navigable channel is much narrower. And then in the summer, the ice retreats, you've got much more sea to play with, but of course it's daylight all the time, so you can be found by reconnaissance more or less 24 hours a day. So the problem for PQ-17 was it was summer, and they were likely to be found because not only Germans have U-boat patrols, but they also have air cover from Norway that allows them to detect these things. The other problem you've got is that although Bismarck has been sunk in 1941, her sister ship Tirpitz is still available to the Germans to use. It's the sister ship of Bismarck. It's as big, as powerful, as important a unit. But in the summer of 42, Tirpitz was up in the fjords of Norway, and the worry was it would do exactly what Bismarck had done the year before. It would sail into the Atlantic and attack convoys, and we'd be back to square one. All the same trouble would be caused all over again.
Of course, it would be a worry, because in the Atlantic, there'd been huge losses to convoys, and so that could possibly be replicated with something of the might and size and scale and power of the Tirpitz.
Absolutely. I mean, in the Arctic Ocean, the Royal Navy is facing three threats. There's the U-boats that we're all familiar with. German bombers from Norway were quite capable of striking convoys in the Arctic, so there's an air threat as well. But Tirpitz adds a third dimension to that, because if you have powerful surface ships like that, they could wreak real havoc. And the Royal Navy's response to this was that Tirpitz could come out of Norway, but the home fleet of the Royal Navy sits in Scapa Flow in the Orkneys, and so we had a pretty powerful naval force there. And the presumption was that if they knew Tirpitz was coming out, and this for this you rely on both intelligence for Bletchley Park, but also air cover reconnaissance flights over the fjords, trying to see where she is, whether she's sailing, whether she's getting up to whatever. The idea was that if Tirpitz and the rest of the German surface fleet sailed, we could put a comparable fleet out from Scapa Flow and discourage them or have a big naval battle or whatever. So when PQ-17 sails, there is quite a complex plan that involves the close escort of the convoy itself, which is small destroyers, frigates, and other vessels, which are essentially anti-submarine ships sailing immediately with the convoy. And that's similar to the kind of escorts that convoys would have had in the Atlantic. And they're pretty good against submarines, but they're going to stand no chance against big German battleships. So there were two shadowing forces. There was a force of cruisers, sort of medium-sized warships, that were quite close to the convoy. And there was also a much larger force of British battlecruisers and battleships, and including the aircraft carrier Victorious, that sailed from Scapa. And the idea was that they would not quite go with the convoy, but they would sort of hang around over its shoulder, ready to intervene should the Germans come out. And it's in the relationships between these various forces, between what the Germans might do if they sail and how the Navy might respond to it, that the problem with the convoy arises.
Northwards to the Arctic Circle rides the convoy and escort bound for ports in northern Russia. Over 2,000 miles of dangerous waters, traversing the hard route that leads to Murmansk and Archangel. Laden with great cargoes of war material from Britain's factories, our ships head up to those northern latitudes, carrying the weapons that Russia calls for. Upon the broad shoulders of the Royal Navy is placed the heavy and perilous task of getting the supplies to their destinations. Apart from the many hazards of war faced by the men who take the ships to the Soviet, they have to bear the full rigors of Arctic weather. And when the temperature drops far below zero, so intense is the cold that metal on the upper decks and the guns burns the flesh from their hands. Notwithstanding this, ceaseless watch is kept at all times of day and night. Out of the dim light of approaching night, an enemy bomber discovers the convoy, and in the gathering gloom comes into attack. But the British Bulldog is very much awake.
The help which Britain is giving to the Soviet is no light thing to be brushed aside. As her ally, we are fulfilling our obligations and will continue to do so until the Nazis are finally obliterated by the United Nations.
These are British tanks destined for the battlefront in Russia. Light and medium armored destroyers by the trainload, going to reinforce the fighting Soviet army in that death struggle of men and machines on the Eastern Front. Outward bound, they're convoyed by warships, heading for the Arctic Circle, over 2,000 miles of dangerous waters, traversing the icy route that leads to Russia. Off the bleak northern tip of Norway, as the Arctic night falls, lookouts spot Nazi bombers sneaking in to attack. Pom-poms, anti-aircraft guns blaze into action. But the convoy goes through. Help for embattled Russia in a steady stream of iron ships and iron men.
What happened was Bletchley got notice a couple of weeks before PQ-17 sailed that the Germans were developing a plan. There were messages that were intercepted relating to an operation called Rösselsprung, which means knight's move in chess. And the Germans had discussed sending Tirpitz and her accompanying ships out to attack an Arctic convoy. We didn't know which one, but it was clear that they had that project in mind. The limiting factor for the Germans was they had to know where Victorious and the British heavy squadron were in order to do it, because they wanted to get Tirpitz out, attack the convoy and get back before they could be intercepted by the heavy units, the Royal Navy. So there's kind of a game of cat and mouse going on, because the Royal Navy can't keep those big ships at sea for long periods. They can't just sit in the Arctic and wait. And they would have been themselves vulnerable to German air power if they were there. So they're in Scapa waiting to see whether Tirpitz is going to sail. And Tirpitz, in turn, the Germans are sitting there waiting to figure out where the Royal Navy is and whether it's worth a sort of a dash out to get a convoy and get back before they get intercepted. And in the middle of it is the convoy sailing along. And so the question all the time for the Admiralty and for Sir Dudley Pound, who was First Sea Lord, head of the Admiralty, his question to Bletchley all the time is, what's Tirpitz doing? What's Tirpitz doing?
So Dudley Pound knows that intelligence that he's getting, it's not disguised for him like it is a lot of other commanders. He knows that this is from an intercepted message from a German naval post somewhere.
Yes.
That's interesting, because that's unusual, isn't it?
It is. He was one of the few people. I mean, he's the seagoing head of the Navy, so he's two rungs down the ladder from Churchill, so he's very important. What you have to understand is how the Navy runs battles in World War II. And there's a big building on Horse Guards Parade, big ugly concrete thing covered in ivy called the Citadel, which we're all probably familiar with. In the basement of that was a complex of rooms where they had basically big maps of all the world's oceans on the wall, and they were able to communicate with Royal Naval ships at sea from there and basically run the war from that room. The equivalent now is the combined centre at Northwood, where you have, as we speak, there's people sitting there running anti-piracy operations in the Red Sea from North London.
It's interesting that they didn't move that out of the centre of London, which was being bombed to heck.
Well, they put it in a deep basement under several thousand tonnes of concrete, so
they're probably fairly safe.
They were fairly safe. If London had been bombed flat, the Citadel would probably be the last thing to survive. Whereas Churchill's bunker next door was protected by about 2 feet of tarmac and sand. If a bomb had hit that, it would have destroyed it completely. Anyway, they're down there, and in there they have some areas which are restricted to people who are indoctrinated into the Bletchley
secret,
and other areas that aren't. So they had sort of secret plotting rooms, and Pound had clearance to go where he wanted. So he could go down there and he could read the traffic. He could talk to the people who were producing it. So he's fully au fait with the source of information. But he was very keen to get a sort of a concrete answer to his question. And previously, having been aware that the German operation might happen, he's recorded having a conversation with Admiral Tovey, who was the commander in Scapa, that if the Tirpitz came out towards a convoy, that convoy might have to scatter to avoid being destroyed. And Tovey's reply at the time was that would be, he used the phrase, sheer bloody murder, that scattering a convoy with that many U-boats and German aircraft around would have left them.
So it just makes it easy for them
to be
attacked.
They would have just been picked off individually. So it's kind of a no-win situation, but it shows Pound's thinking before PQ-17 had ever even sailed. So the convoy is at sea, and Bletchley starts to get information to suggest that the Germans are doing something. A number of their ships had been in ports in southern Norway, and they moved north, and Tirpitz herself sailed from a fjord in northern Norway round right up to North Cape, right up to the very northern tip of Norway. So it was pretty obvious that something was brewing. And so Pound is asking the liaison officers in the OIC and Bletchley, sort of hour by hour, what can you tell me? Has the ship sailed? Has the ship sailed? Can the convoy carry on? Can the various escort groups carry on what they're doing? Or do we need to respond to Tirpitz? And at this period, although German naval enigma is being broken, it's taking a little while to break it. And the way they construct the key settings on the German enigma means that you have kind of 48-hour windows where the traffic is read, and then they'll change the settings, and then you get a pause before Bletchley can get back into the next day's keys, and then you break it again for the remainder of that 48-hour period, and then so on. So it's almost like a lighthouse, kind of the lights going on and off in terms of the intelligence information available. And they get these messages saying that Tirpitz has moved north, and they get messages saying that her destroyer escorts have been told to refuel immediately, all of which is indicating that she might have gone to sea. And so naturally, Pound and the other Pip and Admiralty are going, as soon as she sails, we need to know. However, Harry Hinsley and his colleagues in Hut 4 back at Bletchley have a much more sort of nuanced understanding of what's going on. And they are using a lot of negative evidence in the sense that one of the things that they'd noticed about the Germans was if Tirpitz was at sea, although she'd maintained radio silence so that she couldn't be intercepted with direction finding, the onshore headquarters would send her lots of messages. So the fact that no messages are being sent to her suggests she's not at sea.
But and there were a lack of something.
It's sort of a lack of information
concrete
that's giving you the clue as well. And also they're listening to German Luftwaffe traffic, which was much, much easier to break. And Hut 6 were breaking that very effectively. And normal procedure would be that if Tirpitz was going to sail, reconnaissance aircraft would be sent out in advance to check the bits of sea she was going to sail in, to check there was nothing there. Similarly, U-boats would be warned in advance. So the lack of all those messages is a sign that she's probably not sailed. And in the case of the naval headquarters messages to Tirpitz, you don't even need to be able to break them. You just need to know that they exist. So the fact they're not being sent is a pretty good clue. And the final sort of piece of evidence was that there were a lot of U-boats shadowing the convoy. And you don't want your own submarines in the same bits of sea as your own surface ships, because the possibility of confusion and getting sunk by your own side is very, very high. So almost inevitably, there would have been messages to those U-boats saying, look out, Tirpitz is coming, because they didn't want it to get sunk by a U-boat.
Yeah.
So it's all about absence of evidence. And it all came to a head on the evening of the 4th of July, because at noon that day, there were changes to the German system, German key settings, which meant that Bletchley was blacked out. But then by the early evening, they're starting to decipher stuff, and so messages are coming through. But at that point, there could have been 6 hours, 7 hours since midday when Tirpitz could have sailed, and no one would have known. So Admiral Pound's saying, I need to know, is she at sea or not? And they're saying, well, we haven't been able to read the messages to say whether she's gone or not, but the absence of even intercepting the kinds of messages that we've been talking about suggests that she hasn't. And he basically pressed them for 100%, can you tell me she's not at sea?
And they
said,
couldn't.
No, we can't. At which point he said, well, we have to assume she is. And at that point, he made the, in hindsight, fatal decision to tell the convoy to scatter and to tell the cruiser escorts. Again, the cruisers would have stood no chance against Tirpitz. So the cruiser escorts are told to hightail it back. The convoy is told to scatter and go its own way. And so instead of those ships being in a tight cluster, protected by all the destroyers and surface escorts they had, they were all basically on their own. And the U-boats and German bombers after that had a field day and 24 out of 35 ships are sunk.
So disastrous. So how many lives were lost?
The loss of life isn't as high as it sometimes is with naval battles because the merchant ships typically have much smaller crews. But nonetheless, 150 merchant seamen are killed. And it was one of the worst convoy losses in the history of the Arctic. What's interesting is Tirpitz did sail on the 5th of July.
The very next day.
The very next day. And went a certain distance out into the Arctic Ocean. But at that point, it became apparent that the convoy had scattered and that the U-boats and German bombers were doing a perfectly good job. So they turned around and went back. And Hinsley, who was not only there at the time breaking the codes in Hut 4, but went on to write the official history of British intelligence in the Second World War. He says in his book, kind of in Pound's defence, that had the convoy not scattered and carried on its merry way to Russia, a day later, Tirpitz would have turned up. And the outcome that Pound was trying to avoid would have transpired anyway. So they were kind of damned if they did and damned if they didn't, because the decision he took was the wrong one at the time he took it, but he would have been faced with an equally awkward decision the following day. And the outcome might have been very, very similar. So
he almost couldn't win, could he?
He couldn't win. It's the nature of intelligence and warfare in general that sometimes these situations are unwinnable.
Do we have any sense, does history tell us anything about the way it affected him or his career or his record, how he was perceived?
Well, one of the things that's argued in his defence is that by this point in 1942, he was quite ill. He subsequently died in 1943 of a brain tumour and was replaced by Admiral Cunningham. So he wasn't a well man.
Convoy route to Murmansk, past Hitler's bomber bases in Norway, was the most perilous stretch of the Atlantic. Over this route, the Nazi Luftwaffe held pitiless and unbreakable sway. From their bases all along the coast, German long-range bombers lay in wait to spot the convoys and keep them under surveillance until short-range dive bombers could strike. At all costs, the Nazis were determined to stop the flow of Lend-Lease aid to Russia. Men of the Navy and the Merchant Marine knew that assignment to the Murmansk run was almost a sentence of eventual death. But for every ship destroyed, for every crew lost, a dozen others got through with their cargoes intact. To Londonderry, to Murmansk, under a hail of bombs and through the wolf packs, the Atlantic convoys got through.
Did this, with that curse of hindsight, did it make any changes to the way things worked between the Admiralty and Bletchley Park, or the way that intelligence was processed and received by the Admiralty?
I think it sits on the sort of learning curve of how Bletchley Park intelligence was used, and the Admiralty go on to refine their procedures as the war goes on. But the problem with these kind of things is there's not much you can change. The convoys have to carry on. Tirpitz was still there. The ship loss for the Arctic convoys is about 1 in 10, 1 in 11. So the old saying is not great if you're one of them. But as a project, it was relatively successful. Most of the goods we tried to send to the Russians did get there. But this is the exception that proves the rule, if you like. This was the one occasion when the Germans were able to strike really successfully against those convoys.
Given that that operation, from Germany's point of view, was a success, what did the Tirpitz then go on to do after that?
It's a bit of an irony that Tirpitz went on to do almost nothing. She stayed in the Norwegian fjords for the next 2 years, but she remained a threat in being, and it was a massive preoccupation for not only the Royal Naval, but Churchill himself, that she was there, she was a threat in being. At any point, she might either break out into the Atlantic and attack convoys there, or she might carry on attacking ships in the Arctic.
And why was that? Was she intended as a deterrent?
She was intended for active service. She ended up serving as a deterrent. But part of the reason was that, having lost Bismarck, Hitler was very concerned for her security. And while it would have been great to get her out in the Atlantic sinking things, the risk was so great that he never really was prepared to chance it. And actually, so long as she sat there in Norway, she was sucking up a huge amount of Allied effort and causing us a massive worry. I mean, a series of operations are launched. She's bombed a number of times by more conventional bombers. She's attacked by midget submarines. They're always trying to come up with different schemes to sink Tirpitz. And the ship isn't finally, well, it's capsized rather than sunk, isn't finally destroyed until November 1944. So way after D-Day and everything else. So, you know, it's been sitting there all of that time.
This is the death of the battleship Tirpitz. RAF Lancaster's roar to the attack. And here is the 45,000-ton pride of the German Navy firing desperately at the air raiders. A 6-ton armor-piercing blockbuster is on its way. The Tirpitz is mortally hit, but replies with everything, including 15-inch guns, in this climactic battle of Tromsø Fjord in Norway. Another near hit. The RAF is scoring after two previous unsuccessful attempts from Scottish bases 1,200 miles away. Another blockbuster heads for the target. Perfect weather sweeps away the defensive smokescreen, and another hit is registered. These RAF pictures show the death agonies of the crippled monster. Months of preparation went into the assault. The RAF, in sinking the Tirpitz, turned in one of its greatest jobs.
Looking at the battle that the convoys had throughout the war, how big or small does this figure in that, and how well recognised were the people involved?
Well, the story of PQ-17 was in all the papers at the time, and it has been notorious ever since as one of the worst disasters to befall a convoy. But ironically, the people who, particularly the merchant seamen who were involved for the rest of the war, more or less, on that route, although it was a particularly grim journey, particularly in the winter, they didn't get any formal recognition until very, very late. A formal campaign medal for the Arctic convoys, the Arctic Star, as it's called, wasn't actually introduced until 2012. You can spot them at the cenotaph every November because Arctic convoy veterans wear white berets and you see them marching in the procession and they're very distinctive.
To reflect on the whole thing, it's about, you've got to make a choice, haven't you? If you're in charge of the field of battle and you're being provided with this intelligence, there's a great leap of faith in how much you trust it and go with it. We're just saying, I think it hasn't sailed. I know quite a lot about this. How much faith could they be expected to put in that? Hindsight can be very cruel, can't it?
Hindsight is very cruel, and intelligence is never perfect. It's very easy to think that Bletchley Park were able to snatch the exact answer out of the ether and make the life of the generals easy. It wasn't like that at all. It was always inference, snippets, small bits of information that would give you a pretty good idea, but then ultimately the responsibility lay with the commanders in the field to use a bit of judgment, use a bit of intuition, and take what sometimes were fatal decisions.
We present the Soviet newsreel story of the Prime Minister's four-day visit to Moscow. On the afternoon of the day of his arrival at an airport of the Russian capital, Soviet, British and American representatives, headed by Monsieur Molotov, came forward as the Giant Liberator Commando taxied to rest after its long journey from Cairo. At the invitation of Monsieur Stalin, Mr. Churchill had come at the head of an Anglo-American delegation for the war's most vital series of conferences. As the Premier set foot on Russian soil for the first time, he was met by Monsieur Molotov, who, as a signatory to the Anglo-Soviet Treaty in London recently, became one of the principal architects in the Allied task of building for victory.
And we are determined that we will continue hand in hand. Whatever our suffering, whatever our toils, we will continue hand in hand like comrades and brothers until every vestige of the Nazi regime has been beaten into the ground until the memory only of it remains as an example and a warning for future times.
The official reception over, the delegates entered a fleet of waiting cars to be driven straight to the Kremlin. As he entered, the Prime Minister gave his famous V sign for the cameraman's benefit. An hour and a half after the Liberator had landed, Mr. Churchill with Mr. Harriman were starting their talks with Premier Stalin. Although the British and Soviet leaders have corresponded freely during the past 15 months, this is the first time they had met. This initial conference lasted nearly 4 hours, business being conducted through interpreters. Nevertheless, the discussions were carried on in an atmosphere of cordiality and complete sincerity. Among attributes they have in common are courage, determination, and ample qualities of leadership. It will have been noticed that Monsieur Stalin was wearing his customary semi-uniform of light brown, while Mr. Churchill had donned the siren suit so often seen during his visit to America. The Stalin pipe and the Churchill cigar had not yet been lit, but plenty of tobacco was burnt during the many hours the Allied leaders were together, working in close and friendly collaboration. The mission to Moscow drew to a close as dawn broke over the Moscow aerodrome. By the growing light of another day, the Prime Minister and his party prepared to journey back to Cairo and then on to Britain. 4 days in Moscow had done much to forward the new help. Approaching history will reveal the full scope of the plans that were settled in Moscow. Today we see the dawn of greater things by the combined strengths of the USSR, the USA, and us.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and Catherine White and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, don't be shy, write us a ripping review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.